Okay, so this is actually not the last talk. I always give another talk later on this afternoon. Just like sometimes people come and ask me questions and they say, oh, just one question, Ajahn Brahm. And there always be three or four questions later. Oh, just the last question now. But it's nice actually, as Ajahn Chah used to say, it's nice when you can do things which have a finish to them, which have an end to them. Because many things in life, they don't have an end to them. They just keep going on and on and on and on. And much of that is your life. Whether it's, you know, getting on in the world, whether it's renovating your house, whether it's getting relationships, or work, whatever. Some things never have an end. You do one thing and another thing comes up afterwards. However, the meditation, or the right type of meditation, does have an end to it. You feel that there's things completed. There's things which are seen, or once seen, will never be forgotten. Things which are let go of, which once you've let go of, will be gone forever. And it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that. So even though that sometimes it feels like hard work, or it's slow work, even so that this practice of meditation is very, very, very powerful. It does change people's lives, there's no doubt about that. And it changes people's lives in a couple of ways. It not only changes their life in the way that they react to other people, to themselves and to their life, their work, when they go back home. It also changes the way they look at life in a more deeper sense. It really does reinforce one's ideas, knowledges, faith if you like, one's views about the Dhamma. Because it's all very well just to read these things in books. It's already all right to hear them from monks or nuns. And you can discuss them with your friends. But it doesn't really end things. It's only just a theory, a postulation, which unless you check it out and test it out and see if it's true, you'll just stay at that level, the level of view, a level of just ideas. But one of the great things about this meditation retreat is that some of those things which you've read about, which you've heard, which you've discussed with others, you're actually putting into practice. And actually you're experiencing these for yourself. It's one of the reasons that why I teach these retreats at a very, very high level. Teaching jhanas and teaching these great nimittas, encouraging people to do things like even remember past lives. And some monks become crazy doing that. What are you doing that for? That's just too high. Just teach them just how to be mindful and just to eat their meals without shutting it down too fast. Or just teach them how just to be able to get on with their husband, with their wife or whatever. But I always disagree with that. I think it's wonderful to be able to teach at a very high level. Because when you teach at a high level, there are some people actually reach that level. It's quite inspiring, for me to, okay, let's give it a try, let's teach right to the very end and see what happens. Sometimes most people don't, reach the jhanas or enlightenment, but at least some get there. And those who don't get there, that they still get a long way on the path. It is as if that when you make a very, very high goal, then people actually reach much further along that path than they would do if you just kept the goals quite mundane. So because we talk about jhana, we talk about nimittas, we talk about enlightenment, you'll probably find in this retreat you've gone much further than you probably expected. Simply because you were pulled along by that aspiration. And also you get pulled along by some people who can get deep meditation. As I said earlier, that sometimes when someone gets a deep meditation, others get good meditation at the same time. There is a, there is a sense that we do influence one another, and by meditating together in a retreat situation, it's as if the whole group builds up power, and the strong meditators pull along the weak ones, and that way that everybody really sort of develops. So the retreats are good in that way. I certainly found that out in my own monastery when one monk has a good meditation and many monks have good meditation at that same time. It's as if the energies of one lift up the energies of many others. So that we have had a very, very high retreat. Even if you don't reach those levels on this retreat, you don't lose out because you build up the momentum, you build up the understanding and the wisdom based on your experience. And little by little, every retreat you go on, the meditation gets deeper. You get more skilled. And as you go on from retreat to retreat, eventually those skills build up. That ability of the mind to let go, the understanding how to let go, increases and increases. Until, as I said during one of those talks, it's like the water jar. One day you're sitting, could be anywhere, and then without any expectation you get a deep meditation. Even if you only get one of those deep meditations in your life, that's really worthwhile. Because it does change you. It does show you a different aspect, or a different way of looking at life, a different state of consciousness, a different experience of what happiness really is. And just let's just take that experience and just see just how much of the teachings of the Buddha you can understand from that. You've got the basic teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, all about happiness and suffering. That's actually what the Buddha said again and again. That's all he teaches. He said, suffering and the end of suffering. In other words, suffering and happiness. So that's all that is ever taught. But how does that relate to your meditation? Sometimes that people just think about those teachings and they think, oh, that makes a lot of sense, I'm suffering in life. But that's not what suffering means. So I mentioned in one of those talks, using the simile of the tadpole in the lake and the tadpole getting out of the lake. It's only when you get out of that lake you know what water is. And this is why there's just one experience of bliss in deep meditation, which you'll remember for many, many, well, for all your lifetime. You can't forget it. There you have been a tadpole, you've got out of the water for the first time. My goodness, that will, they used to say in the hippie days, blow your mind. It really makes you spin that such happiness is available and is possible. What that does, that reflection, will give you huge amounts of insight into what suffering is and what happiness is. But more than that, it gives you really great insight into the second and third noble truths, the causes of suffering and the causes of the end of suffering, of happiness. Because when you get into those states of just deep bliss, where much of the 99% of the suffering of being has disappeared, you actually start to look, how did that happen? What did I do? How did that come about? What is the cause for the end of suffering? In really investigating this wonderful third noble truth. That's actually how we investigate it, based on deep experience of huge amounts of dukkha, suffering, disappearing. When we look back on those experiences, we see that what we really did was letting go. Going against craving. Not going out into the world or onto the future or back into the past. The first talk I gave about what's called the arsals, the outflowings, one has gone in the opposite direction. One has gone in. One has given up trying. One has given up expectations. One has given up controlling. One has even given up one's will. And when one does that, one gets this amazing amount of peace and bliss. One ends suffering. And then when you read what the Buddha said, he said if you keep doing that, you'll end suffering completely. One of the great sayings of the Buddha, however much you abandon the sensory world, to that amount you'll experience happiness. If you give up this sensory world completely, then you'll experience complete happiness. Very powerful saying. And we really want to know what suffering and happiness truly is. And the way to get not just ordinary happiness, but the deep, the powerful happinesses. And you're also understanding these teachings and the Four Noble Truths. These are sometimes teachings which you hear when you first come into Buddhism. But you need the meditation to truly understand what those mean. And those experiences you get open up huge insights into what suffering is, or what the end of suffering is, and why suffering is ending, and why suffering is caused. you can experience in your own practice of meditation that when you try and control, when you try and do something, the whole process stops and you create suffering for yourself. You are the creator of suffering when you interfere, when you crave. You know, when you sort of try to take a photo of enlightenment. I always remember that one occasion when I was in 2021, I was travelling in India. I'd always wanted to see the Himalaya mountains. So some of my friends had been there and just said just how breathtakingly beautiful they were. So I just finished the university. And the last vacation, I thought, before you had to go and do some work, I went over to India. But I wasn't smart. I never planned the trip properly. Because as soon as I got into India, I realized I'd come in the monsoon season. When there's so many clouds, you never saw the Himalayas. There were just, the whole north was just full of these rain clouds. So I thought, well, that's never mind. I have to come back another time, sometime. This was like in, what, July, August, September. Really heavy rain time. But nevertheless, there's many other places to go to in India and just go visit the holy places and go up to the north and into Nepal and even up to the Tibetan border. But one day, I was up in the north of Nepal somewhere and the truck or the bus which I was travelling in stopped for a tea break. And they said they're going to be there for about an hour. And there's two Americans in the bus. And so we saw this hill, and the three of us, let's get some exercise, let's walk up this hill, see what's on top. That's all we did. We went up that hill, and on top of that hill, as soon as we got up there, the clouds parted. And you saw this amazing whole horizon filled with these tremendous, beautiful mountains, the Himalayas. And like my dream had suddenly become real. I actually could see them. Oh, it was beautiful. So you know what I did. I ran down the hill because my camera was in the bus. And I ran up as fast as I could. And as soon as I got up there, just about a couple of seconds before I got up, so the Americans had just sat up the hill and enjoyed it, the clouds closed up. And that was it for the whole trip. Never saw them again. And the two Americans said, where did you go? It was just, you missed, it's beautiful. And I went to get my camera. I felt so stupid, but I learned my lesson. Whenever you get a moment of beauty, a moment of insight, a moment of deep happiness, you can't capture it with a camera. Nor can you capture it with a camera in your mind, trying to note it down, trying to attach to it. That's why that, you know, some of you may have had limiters come up, and you do the same as me trying to take a photograph. You try and capture it, but you can't capture these beautiful states of mind. You've got to leave them alone. Even capturing is a type of attachment. And whenever you have any attachments, you spoil the path out of suffering. You're creating the pain, the difficulty, the suffering. So that was actually teaching me, and as it teaches you, what the Buddha meant by craving and suffering, and why that's a cause of suffering. It's not a theory anymore. You actually experience it, you know it, because you see how it works. And that way you learn so much about what the Buddha taught. And as you learn little by little on this path into deep meditation, as you come across these very refined attachments and cravings which ordinary people just don't even realize exist, you come into the root of those cravings. You come into the root of the attachments. It's not just seeing the external attachments, it's actually seeing where they come from. And of course, what you actually see is just the play of this self and the person you think you are. That has always been and will be the root of attachments and cravings. And as you go into deep meditation, you see that. But you don't see that if you don't aim for the very, very deep jhanas. You don't go on that route where you see the self disappear on the way in. So you never really understand what this self is. Just like that tab cord again. You've been with this assumption of self, with this experience of self, since you were born, since before you were born, for lifetimes. And because you never got out of that assumption of self, you don't really know what it is. But once it disappears, as you enter those deep meditation states, just like the tadpole is now out of the water, ah, that's what water is. In those deep meditation states, afterwards you can know, ah, that's what the illusion of self was. That's what Ajahn Brahm always meant by this doing business, by the will. You experience it for yourself. So as you practice this path more and more, you get incredible insights, experiential insights, deep insights, which you cannot gain in any other way. And little by little, you unravel the attachments. Gradually, you actually abandon this illusion of self. The more you let go of those attachments, the more happiness you get. And that is the incentive for the mind to let go even more. The more you understand selflessness, the easier it is to meditate, just to let go, to be at peace. It means you become more selfless. The side effect of that, as I was saying yesterday, was you become more compassionate, more kind. You become a gentler person. In Western parlance, we say much of the problems of people becomes because they become control freaks. The more of a control freak you are, just the more frustrated and angry you are, and the less easier it is to live with you. As you understand these dhammas, these insights, it's quite natural that you let go of controlling, because you don't control your own mind, you don't try and control others. Because you let go of attachments, you're more free. And because you're more free, you're not such a control freak, you're much happier. You're less moved by the problems and the troubles, the frustrations and the disappointments of life. You're not trying to control this life anymore. Instead of controlling it, you're letting it go. You're accepting, embracing it, being at peace with it. Which is what we mean by compassion. Not so much compassion to other people, not compassion to yourself. What I mean is compassion to life. Being kind to existence. Even those things which before could have caused you pain, which could have caused you great disappointment, even grief, such as loss of wealth, or just loss of your good health with a cancer or something, or the loss of a loved one, like in a death. Those things don't tend to bother you anymore. Because you don't control life anymore. You know this is part of life. Then your loved ones, even children, will die. You can't control that. That's the way the things truly are. Sometimes you're wealthy, sometimes you lose it. You can't control that. Your relationships, they ebb, they flow. Can't control that too much, not even your children. So much of life you cannot control. You realize that. So you never try to control the uncontrollable. Controlling the uncontrollable is what is the cause of dukkha. So as we understand these things, we tend to become more peaceful and calm in our daily lives. And you will find this, without exception, all those of you who have meditated here. When you go out afterwards, after this afternoon, after we finish, you'll find you're so much calmer, more peaceful. Even to the point that I have to give you a warning, that when you drive away out here, if you've had some deep meditation, just drive around the block a couple of times. Don't go on the main roads. Because sometimes you're so cool, you don't realize just how cool and calm you've become. If you go on the main road, there's too many people going too fast. That's what it happens. Here, everyone else has calmed down and cooled down at the same rate, so you don't really realize it. You go out there and you think, wow, there's craziness out there. Certainly remember the first time I did an extended retreat. When I left a retreat place, I couldn't believe just how crazy people were, how fast they were, how loud they spoke, and how scattered everything was. I was still at the retreat center, still peaceful. Until after a couple of days, I was just as loud, just as scattered, still running around. It didn't last very long, but at least I realized what was happening. But there was always a residue which lasts. If nothing else, it's the memory of peace, the memory of calm. the memory of her happiness, which was so simple, which never needed any sort of music or drink or other people, or you weren't being entertained from outside. You had this very, very simple happiness, which didn't depend upon external stimulation. In fact, the more external stimulation there was, the further away from this happiness. Find another way to be, another way of happiness. What that really means is that you can live in the world, you can have your relationships, you can have your children, you can have your wealth, your trips, your movies, whatever, but they're not so necessary. You can have them, you can take them or you can leave them, because you've got something else. Something which is more important. You've got another layer of being, another layer of happiness, which other people don't have. And when you have that resource, that inner resource, what Ajahn Chah used to call the inner home, then whatever happens out there in the world, you've always got a place to come back to, a reference point, a place which puts this world in perspective. The idea of an inner home is a very beautiful metaphor, because the ideal home, it's a place where you can come back to rest. It's not a place where you have the conflicts of the world or the busyness of the office. A real home should be a place where you can come back, relax, not have to compete, not have to fight, not have to prove anything, not have to fix up the faults. A place where you can really relax and just be at peace with your family. The place of what we call love, real love. We say, the door of my heart's open, no matter what happens, whoever's in here. Now that's the real, the ideal home, which is of course a fantasy for most people's home lives. But at least we can find that ideal home within ourselves. Once we have an ideal home, we can actually rest there. We can recuperate, recharge our batteries, and then in the morning when we have to go out to work and do our jobs, our duties in the world, there we go out refreshed. And of course that ideal home is inside of you, the deep meditation, the peace, the joy. That's what I meant by the ideal home, the inner home, our real home. When you can get into that real home deep inside of you, then you always have a place of rest. Doesn't matter how busy you have been in your life, no matter how many troubles, difficulties, disappointments you have, you've got a place to come back to, which keeps everything in perspective. When you haven't got that home, when you only know the world of toil and strife, of sickness and arguments, you've got no place of balance. You've got no refuge, no place where you can just disappear and just rest and get some perspective on life. And that's why many people go crazy. If you've got that ideal home, you just go back and rest and say, well, yeah, if things go well, then things don't go well. If people die, people live, get rich or lose those riches. The monastery becomes successful, it doesn't become successful, so what? Because you have your inner home. A place where you can really rest. That's the most important. That's why it's called a refuge. And once you know meditation, you have that refuge. You have that peaceful inner home. And after a lot of meditation, you can go back there whenever you want. It's a great thing for a monk to be able to do that. It's a time of peace, time of sickness, time of whatever. You can always go inside. Whether you're sitting on an aeroplane or sitting on a hut, wherever you are, you can always go inside, rest and get perspective on what's going on. This is actually the benefits of this meditation in your daily life. It means after a little bit of meditation, you won't be so burnt out by the struggle of life. You find you have more energy, more acceptance. Your mind is wider and softer to be able to accept much more. Softer so it doesn't break like a brittle plate when it's dropped on the floor. You become more able to cope with life. And I always find that with meditators. meditators can cope more. And don't think this meditation is just for enlightenment. It does actually help you in your work, in your life. Somebody told me that so I can tolerate anything. I've got a soft mind. You can do whatever you want. Sometimes, imagine being a monk. If I didn't have sort of a soft mind, if I couldn't meditate, oh, I'd get so upset at you guys. But you never do get upset. Oh, you can do whatever you want. Say silly things, do silly things. Who cares? Well, I'm not going to laugh. That's going to make me unhappy. But so when you start to become peaceful, you find that you don't get angry, you don't get upset. Your work goes much better. I was going to say that there was a friend who was applying for some job. I think it was in some sort of social service. And when they went for the interview, they asked her, "What do you do?" And she mentioned that she meditated. And apparently the person doing the interview said, "You're a meditator?" Said, "Yeah, you get the job." She gave the job straight away just on the grounds of a meditator, because they knew that meditators can handle stress better than anybody else. So, because you've been here for these 9 days, that's an extra thing you can put on your CV. You're a meditator, you can take more stressful jobs. But not only that, I'm not sure, I mean, you're from LA, you should be able to confirm this. Somebody even told me that, you know, because you have to get your own health insurance in the US, but if you actually put down in your health insurance, you're a meditator, and you get a monk or somebody to actually to sign that, yes, they're a meditator, you can get a reduction in your health payments.
I didn't know that, but I was
actually
getting
that. And there's good reason for that, because you're a meditator in your car, you don't get so upset and angry. And it means you'll actually live longer, your stress levels are much less. So you should get a reduction in the premiums. So remember, the Buddhist side of West Australia gets 10%. No, don't worry, joking about that. So, but it's true that you can get a reduction in the health premiums. So meditation actually works, but not only that. You become much more sensitive to yourself and to other people. And that sensitivity to yourself and other people is another reason why you don't get so sickly, why you don't get so angry. If people only realised what they were doing to themselves, if they really felt it deep inside, you wouldn't rush around so much. You wouldn't get angry at others. You wouldn't get so depressed and complaining. And when you're complaining to somebody else about, "Oh, my husband, oh, my kids, oh, my life, oh, my monster." If you actually listen actually to how it feels when you complain, it's a rotten feeling inside. It's not worth doing. It doesn't actually, you know, you can't change things anyway. I mean, you can't change husbands once you've got them, you're stuck with them. You can actually swap them these days, I suppose, but that's even more problems and suffering. Sometimes it's not worth it. But there's a complaint, just the bare complaining is the problem. Because when you start to complain, this actually creates suffering inside. Is it really, really worth it? When you're sensitive, you can see that. What's the point of me complaining? What's the point of me being grumpy? What's the point of me being angry? Just hurting. When you're sensitive, you start to feel these things inside of yourself. And those unskillful, dysfunctional responses tend to disappear from you. Just through basic sensitivity, the feelings in the body. You become a more peaceful person. Not only that, when you're sensitive to the people you live with, you can actually feel when's the right time to talk about the problems. When's the right time, not to talk about the problem, but to cheer them up. When's the right time to really tell them how much you care for them. You become so much more sensitive to the people around you. And if you're in business, you become much more sensitive to your clients. When's the right time to sell them something? When's the right time just to back off? That sensitivity is so important in business. To the point that some people, they just lose a lot of money because they push at the wrong time, and they give in at the wrong time, because they're not really listening to what's being done or what's being said. Earlier on in this retreat I talked about total listening, when the mind is silent in the present moment, and you can fully take in what someone else is saying to you. You'll be practicing that every time you've gone into silence. When you go out, you can practice that to your wife, to your husband, to your children, to your boss at work, to people who work for you. When you have total listening to somebody else, it's amazing what you pick up. It's amazing what you hear, which you've never heard before. You really start to understand others, to understand where they're coming from, understand why they're doing that. And sometimes people say that during those talks, people come up to you and say, "Ajahn Brahm, that talk was for me, you were reading my mind." You're not reading your mind, all you were doing is total listening, feeling that person. It's by making your mind just so open and really listening, not just to what they say, but where it's coming from. It's incredible the sensitivity which you can gain. And that is a sensitivity which will enhance your life, which will make you better people, which will solve so many problems in your life. And that's why I say this, please develop that total listening. Solve your problems in life. Because if you didn't do that, you'd be coming to me to try and help solve them, or to the other monks, or to sister. And we work too hard already. I want an easy life. So please do that total listening, so you never need to bother me or any of the nuns ever again. It's amazing how much time you have to spend sort of with people's problems. Oh, my husband. Oh, my wife. Oh, my kids. Oh, my work. Oh, my health. Look, shut up and just listen and trouble yourself, for goodness sake. Because you can, and it's much better solving it for yourself, because once you learn how to solve the problems, you can become independent. Sometimes there's not a monk or a nun around. Sometimes there is no friends to help. So, solve it for yourself. Total listening. So this meditation teaches you how to solve your own problems, and how to be happy and peaceful in life, how to be successful, how to be everything you ever wanted to be. And all for, was it, $250? What a bargain. I went to Sydney, and the people I was staying with, their son had gone to the Gold Coast because there was some motivational psychologist for the United States. And they paid $7,000 for the weekend. $7,000! Just for a weekend. So this is a bargain. Top quality, low price. Yeah, absolutely. So, now the point being here that you actually learn these techniques and they actually work. So when you go back, sometimes people say, "Oh, how should I carry on when I go back?" Remember what I've been telling you all the time this week. Stop trying to do it. It will happen naturally. You say, "Oh, what should I do next?" You don't need to say what to do next. You will meditate. You've got no choice anymore. So there's no choice, there's no will business. So you will go back there and you want to sit meditation. Why do you want to sit meditation? Because it was fun, you realize it was valuable. You want to do it. And if you really want to do it, you will. And that's perhaps the best thanks you can give me, and the organizers and the people who helped this retreat. If you go back and want to meditate, then I know we've succeeded. Why do you want to meditate? It's because you find it fun, you find it rewarding. If you do the painful meditations, sitting here and pushing through pain, seeing how many hours you can sit still, see how little sleep you can have, and how little food you can have, you really make this ascetic, austere sort of retreat where it gets so painful. When you get back home, you'll be so glad not to meditate. You'll never meditate for weeks, afterwards. It was just so painful. Even the memory of meditating would give you a shaking with fear. But if you get happiness in meditating and it's got good memories associated with it, you want to do it again. Sometimes, you know, people ask you, why do you meditate? For fun. It's just fun to meditate. Let alone the wisdom which comes from it. It's to sit down and just relax. Oh, it's just beautiful, it's peaceful, it's blissful. And some of you, you know, because you've got very stressful jobs, sometimes your friends, they go off to have a bit of peace, to unwind. They go off to all these resorts, like into Broome, or like Bali, or they go to, what's the best resorts over in Singapore? Pinto, or something? Bintan Island, or Langkawi, or somewhere. So you go to all these places, you know, to have a bit of peace and quiet. And it costs a lot of money. And you've got to pack your bags, and you've got to travel such a long distance. Now you don't need to do that anymore. Whenever you want to go on holiday, just go to your room, sit down, meditate. No baggage, no passports, no visas, no hassle, and away. You're on the most peaceful island in the whole world. The island of Jhana. Or at least the island of letting go. Where you can go there and just really let go and just really relax and be so at peace with yourself. Isn't that wonderful? To have your own holiday resort deep inside yourself. Your own, which only you can get in there. That's your one. Everyone else has got their own ones. Their own condo, resort, hotel, deep inside yourself, with all mod cons, so peaceful, so still. You can go there any time you want, doesn't cost a cent. Isn't that a great resource to have? So what do you do when you meditate? Eventually you've got your own condo inside yourself, a place where you can go to and really relax and make it peaceful. So in order to do that, one of the things I encourage meditators to do, if you haven't done that already, please do this. Even if you live in places like Singapore or LA where the house prices are just so enormous, you can only afford a small apartment. It doesn't matter. In that apartment, there might be a small room. If there's not a small room in the corner of your bedroom, make that your holy corner. Set up a corner of your bedroom or some room. Put a shrine there, put a meditation cushion there, a few photos to give it atmosphere, maybe Buddha statue or flowers or whatever. Just make it your little holy corner, your shrine. You don't need a big place. Simple temples are the best. And use that as your resort, as your refuge. So whenever you want to meditate, you go and sit there. Quietly, peacefully. A place of letting go. But don't do anything else there. Don't take any work there. Don't take a radio there. Don't take a little portable television there. Just so you can get the soccer results. Or whatever else you really like. Don't do anything like that. That is holy place. And only holy things are left, can go in there. Maybe you can take a CD of a talk or chanting or a little Dhamma book. But nothing else. And only use that place for meditation, nothing else, or for reflection. There you go, that's your place where you sit. Tell the rest of your family that no one else can sit there unless they want to meditate. That is holy ground. If you've got your partner, it's hard to actually to deal with, say, that Ajahn Brahm said, that's so holy, that little corner there, if you sit in it, you'll probably be converted. That'll keep him out. That's what we did. Whatever. That's actually what we did our monastery the first year, because we never had a wall in front. We just had like this very rotten, falling down barbed wire fence. So actually, to keep any burglars or any mischief makers out, I wrote this sign on the fence: "Trespassers will be converted." And that really worked. That keeps people out. That's better than trespassing will be convicted. People weren't afraid of the law. Reconverted. Tessa's a big reconverted. Oh, that was scary. So, so you can actually put that little sign on your meditation, because trespassers will be converted, and that will keep your husband or anyone else who's not really interested in meditating out. Well, the point is that because you're keeping it just for one thing and one thing only, it does build up power. It's amazing just what power actually is built up by meditating in the same spot for time after time after time. That's why those stories about power places. Sometimes it may not be a power place in and of its own right, but you build up that power. And if anyone wants to know these powerful places, you go into our monastery at certain times. It's amazing how many people have told me this. I feel this myself. You just go in that gate and you're going into another place. Especially if you're walking. You go out, it's different. Just 5 meters outside that gate, 5 meters inside, it's a different feeling. Even once, there was a friend and she brought an Aboriginal elder to come in. The indigenous people are usually very sensitive. The Aboriginal elder stayed outside and said, "I can't go in unless I'm invited, it's too powerful." She only told me that later on, I invited him in. "Oh, there's this concrete worker who's building our water tanks. And after he finished, he's this really rough Australian. And when you went to speak to him, he was always talking, would never stop. And when he was working, he put the radio on, and there's always some sort of sound there. You know what workers are like. But then at the end of the job, when he finished, he packed his stuff away, and I just went to say goodbye. He said, "Brahm, could I look inside your church?" We called our main hall up the church. And he was, you know, he's a really rough guy, but very, very nice. You can see he had like a golden heart. So I said, "Yeah, come on." And so we walked over there, and he was just talking so loudly all the way over there. But when he went in, so he had his big boots on, and it would take him half an hour to get them off with all the laces and stuff. So he said, "Should I take the boots off?" He said, no, don't take your boots off, just poke your head around the corner. And he was doing that, and he was talking until he put his head in the corner, around the corner. And it was one of those magical experiences, which I'll always remember. He went absolutely quiet. And just looked in there, he just stopped. And I just let him just soak up the peace. And then he turned around with his all cement bespattered face, because he hadn't cleaned up yet, just like a cement builder. He turned around after about, must have been about 3 minutes, and said, "Gaw, this is good, isn't it, Brahm?" It was so sweet. "Oh, this is good, isn't it, Brahm?" He'd actually touched the piece there and he felt it. And just like an ordinary worker who never meditated before in his life, he could actually taste that piece and it calmed him down. So imagine that if you can build up energy places like that in your house. Even though you may be thinking worried, afraid, depressed about something which has happened to you in your life, you can sit in those places and suddenly just become quiet. It helps. So you build up the energy in your little meditation corner. As we build that energy up in our main hall in Serpentine, and many other places where you can build up that energy. And you do get these beautiful, deep peace states. So this is something you can do at home. You can actually build your resort, your Club Med, your little monastery in a corner of your room. And you can sit there. Yeah?
Maybe it's new aging, but does it help to put crystals in there to store your energy that you're building up, or is it just
okay? Crystals, whatever works, give it a try. It doesn't do any harm, but I don't know if it does any good. So just see what happens. So you can put those things in. Yeah, go on.
Let me see, setting up a meditation corner in that room?
Yeah.
If I wish it's not.
No. It's interesting. What's respectful and disrespectful to the Buddha? That in our monastery, if you have a look at our Buddha statue faces west. If you look in the text, the Buddha statues are supposed to face east. And so when we first built that, we put our Buddha statue facing west. Some traditional Buddhists complain. Hey, you Western monks, you don't know how to build monasteries. You made the biggest mistake. The Buddha's facing in the wrong direction. But fortunately, we had a very senior monk from Ajahn Chah's monastery at the time. And he answered all the critics just in one sentence. He said, look, if the Buddha was facing the wrong direction, he'd turn around by himself. Shut up. So if you put in the paper just disrespectful, something will happen. This actually did happen once. This is a spooky story. Here in Perth, someone set up their Buddha shrine in the house. And they asked me, you know, roughly what you do. I said, put it in a high place, some place of respect. And about a couple of weeks later, they came to me. They were very perturbed. Because they put it up in their hallway. And the next morning, they came down. The Buddha statue had moved. And they thought, it's really strange. Oh, it must be one of the kids had moved or something. So they straightened it up again. Next morning, it moved again. So I thought, this is really weird. They asked all the kids, we didn't touch it, Mum, we didn't touch it. So, I don't know, it may have been some sort of vibration, maybe a truck or a lorry outside. So they turned it again, and it turned a third time. No one had touched it. So they asked what had gone on. So, I don't know, give me all the details. Where is it and how is it? And actually it was in front of a mirror, facing itself. It turned around by itself, that was in the appropriate place. If it's not the appropriate place, the Buddha will turn. It's amazing. But the thing is, like, the Buddha's just like in the time, the real Buddha. So what does a Buddha love? Even if it's in a low place, as long as it's being respected, it would work. Because just at the end of the Buddha's life, we just announced that in 3 months he was going to pass away. And because of that, there's so many of his disciples crowded around to get the last teachings, to ask their questions, to do the services. There was one monk who wasn't concerned at all. His name was Dhammarama, one of the heroes. And so the other monks complained, this Dhammarama, he's not coming to do any services. He's not interested in listening to your last talks. There's something wrong with him. Of course, the Buddha knew there was nothing wrong with this monk. But just to show others, he said, call the monk Dhammarama to me. So because the Buddha called him, he had to come. He said, Dhammarama, for the last couple of months, since I've said I was soon going to enter Parinibbana to leave, you haven't attended upon me at all. You show no interest in listening to my last talks or doing any services. Why? Why aren't you paying respect? And Dhammarama said, Bhante, I am paying respect. When I heard that you were going to pass away in 3 months, I realized I hadn't yet attained any depth of meditation or any great insights. And I thought the best way I could pay respect to you was staying in my heart and meditating day and night, being diligent in practicing what you told me to do. Then the Buddha said, sadhu, 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 Dhammarama. That's how you pay respect to a Buddha. Not with flowers, candles and incense. You pay respect to a Buddha by following the teachings of a Buddha and by practicing accordingly. And he became the example of how you pay respect. So even if you have the Buddha low down, even if it's facing a mirror, even in a toilet, but if you're practicing deep meditation in that toilet, this is just an extreme example, this is not advice. But if you're practicing deep meditation in that toilet, the Buddha would not mind. The point was that you were practicing his teachings, and that's the highest respect. So if it's a corner of your bedroom, and even if it's slowed down, if that's the best you can do, as long as you're really paying respect there and doing your best to follow this Eightfold Path, then you'll have no problems whatsoever. That's how you pay respect. The same that I'll just put this in now, The same, some of you have already in that question time said thank you. Thank you to the organizers of this retreat. Thank you for the monks and the nuns sitting here like little Buddhas. Thank you to me for teaching you. The only way you can say thank you to all these people is by practicing accordingly. That's the way you pay respects and say gratitude to a teacher. And if any of you have ever been a teacher or a mother or father, and if you've seen some of your disciples actually gain some of these beautiful states, then that's the best way you can actually say thank you. To give your attainments of peace, insight, bliss, enlightenment, to offer that to your teacher. And that's the highest gift you can give to any teacher. Certainly I know whenever someone comes up and they get their first deep meditation experience, for me that makes it all worthwhile. And all I can teach, and teach until I'm hoarse, teach until I'm really wiped out and tired. And when one person comes up and says, oh, I jumped on, oh, I've done it, oh, then that makes it all worthwhile. And they said thank you for everybody. So that's the way to repay a teacher, to repay a parent, to repay the Buddha. So that's how you really pay respect. So you can put that Buddha statue up there and that will be fine. So that way that we've got a place where we can meditate. And we've got a place where we can develop these states of meditation. It's true that when you go back home it won't be as peaceful as it was here. But sometimes, surprisingly, it is. Sometimes it may be a week or 2 weeks you decide to sit down there. And sometimes you just get back into the groove again. It's as if the momentum of this retreat, everything which you've been building up here, is still growing underneath. The whole sort of cause and effect chain hasn't yet come to its culmination. Because that happens sometimes. People get amazing deep insights in maybe 1 or 2 weeks after deep meditation. As if things have been building up like a volcano. You've put all the causes into effect in this retreat. It's almost coming up, but not quite yet. And sometimes, 1 or 2 weeks afterwards, when you least expect it, it can come up. So sometimes people do get into deep meditations. It's amazing. When they least expect it. Where they get amazing insights, you know, a week or two after going home. So you never know what's going to happen next. But before I finish off, the last thing I'm going to tell you, because if you haven't got the deep meditations yet, there's still a couple of hours left. And if you're really desperate to get a deep meditation, I like telling the story of the bhikkhuni called Siha. Because this bhikkhuni, she'd ordained as a nun, and she'd been practicing for 7 years, not just a 9-day retreat, 7 whole years. And after 7 years, she still hadn't got any peace at all, no nimittas, no jhanas, no deep insights. And that gives encouragement for you. But after 7 years, she decided, what am I going to do? I've given it everything I've got. And I don't want to go back to the lay life. For the nuns, they say, going when they become a bhikkhuni, a nun, they say that they've given up the 3 crooked things. That was like the metaphor in Buddhism. Many of the nuns said that in their poems of enlightenment. How wonderful it was to have given up the 3 crooked things. It was a symbol of their life. In the lay world. The first crooked thing was the ladle they used to cook with in the kitchen. It was a symbol of kitchen work. That's the first crooked thing, the ladle. The second crooked thing they'd given up was the broom. It was a symbol of housework. So when they became a nun, they'd given up cooking, they'd given up housework. And the third crooked thing they'd given up when they became a nun was the husband. Those are the 3 crooked things the nuns say they give up. The ladle, the broom, and the husband. this great sense of humour sometimes in these old Buddhist texts, and not all sort of, you know, dependent origination and Abhidhamma. Some have got some very funny stories. So she wasn't going to go back to the three cookie things. How many of you, when you leave here, are going to go back to the three cookie things? So she didn't want to go back to those. And she didn't know what to do next. She couldn't stay as a nun. There was only one option. She took a long length of rope. She went into the forest. She tied one end of the rope to her neck. Another end of the rope to a branch. She was about to jump off when she got her first deep meditation experience. That was cutting it fine. And even though I say this story, it's not recommended. But it was fascinating. Why did she do that? How come that worked? Similar to the story of Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. He too, when the Buddha was dying, was really meditating hard. Just afterwards, he meditated hard because he was having a big meeting of, was it 500 monks? 499 were fully enlightened. He was the odd one out. Imagine what that's like. If I told you, 40 people in this retreat, 39 are fully enlightened, you are the odd one out. How would you feel? That's how he felt. So he meditated all night. He really gave everything he got. And in the morning again, nowhere. Hadn't made an inch of progress. So what did he do? He said, well, meeting's going to be another hour, so might as well have a bit of a nap. So he decided to sleep. Before his head hit the pillow, he was a 500th arahat, fully enlightened. I know you've been trying that meditation method many times. But why did that happen? When someone's about to sort of go to sleep, when someone's about to jump off, why did they become enlightened or get deep meditation? Because at that point they let go. They stopped trying. They gave up. They renounced. That's why that letting go business is so important. But don't get a length of rope and be about to jump off a tree to let go. Because sometimes you might let go of the wrong thing. You might get in trouble. But what they let go of was trying, controlling, aspiring, willing. That's why they became enlightened. So it reminds you of something, how to do it. So sometimes that momentum of letting go, you've done it for a long time already. You've got some idea, insight, some sort of feeling for it. Maybe later on, that feeling, that insight, it might remind you of a time before you can remember when you've done that before. Because each one of you have done jhanas before. But it's beyond before you remember. But just to get that one back, to know what letting go is, and to go on what the Buddha called the ancient path, the Eightfold Path, the ancient city of Nibbana. So that's there for you. It's only a matter of time. So enjoy the meditation. When you leave here, you won't be able to leave it alone. Find it in the corner of your bedroom or in your house or somewhere and meditate. If you have the opportunities to come on retreats, go on retreats, because it's on the retreat time you really make the most progress. Perfect conditions. And every time you come, you get deeper. And one day, you break through. So, that's what you can expect. Any questions? Yeah?
You just mentioned that most of us have ever attained jhana before.
Sorry?
You know, that most of us have attained jhana before.
Well, because you've been around for such a long time, there's the balance of probability.
Previous lives.
Oh, your previous lives, yeah. Sometimes a long time ago. But sometimes there's a memory in there somewhere. One needs just something to click, and the mind remembers what letting go is, and it abandons, even into the deep meditation states. So it's just the mind remembering how to abandon, how to let go. Isn't it great to be able to do that? Now you may be grieving or upset about something or just worried sick about something in life, because life is like that. It looks like this terrible thing's about to happen. You're going to die, or someone's going to die, or someone's going to go to jail, or the economy's going, or whatever is happening. Isn't it wonderful to be able to pull that away, let it go? To sit down and just bliss out? That all those things don't worry you so much. You become at peace, even in complete catastrophe. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I remember once I was in a bus in Thailand many years ago. And at that particular time, because the buses in that part of Thailand are very old, and they're always catching fire, it seems, because there was these reports almost every other day in the newspapers of like a bus catching fire. Even remember one of the monks I knew, he was in one of those buses, it caught fire. He managed to escape, but he lost all of his bowl and his other robes. You know, once it caught fire, that was it. It's immolated really quickly. So this was a time there was loads of fires on these buses. So I was in a bus one day, and then somebody screamed from the back, "Fire!" And the smoke coming out the back. So I was actually in the front seat. They always put the monks in the front seat, because yes, the monks are supposed to get much good, have more good karma than people sitting behind. So that means you can't have a crash, because the monk's good karma has got a hairbag. So we always have to sit in the front. And some of these drivers, if they see there's a monk in the front, they think, "Oh, I'm safe." And we're the ones who see the traffic coming straight towards us. So it's really scary. But anyway, so I was sitting in the front next to a Thai monk. I was in the window seat, he was the aisle seat, as it were. And when they shout out, "Fire!" the driver slammed on the brakes. He was out the window before the before the bus stopped. And all the other people, before, you know, you could even do anything, they were at the aisle, pushing the doors open. And you know this, like for a monk, especially of our tradition, like Thai monk, all Thai monks, you're not supposed to have any contact with the opposite gender. But this Thai monk sitting next to me, he didn't mind that. He was out pushing past the ladies anyway. And they were all screaming out. But I was a monk who didn't read the newspapers. So I hadn't listened to the radio and didn't know what was going on. I didn't know that all these buses had actually caught fire, and many people had been actually killed in these infernos in the buses. So I didn't know what was going on at all. So I sat there and what's going on? And they were all sort of trying to get out, and I was thinking, this is interesting, what's happening? And at that time, that somebody lingered in the back of the bus, actually saw it. It's only a cigarette. No danger, you can all come back again. So I can force them up. But as everybody came in, even that time monk, they came up to me, "Oh, you're so brave. Oh, you're a real monk. Oh." Even, it wasn't courage, it was stupidity. But even so, I enjoyed it. Imagine if that was real courage. Say, "Oh, okay, you're going to die, so what? Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to do instead of sort of getting upset and angry and getting uptight?" So, if you can really meditate, you can let go. Nothing makes you afraid. Nothing makes you upset. So you can be at peace in the world. And that's a wonderful thing to be. So anyway, any other comments or questions before you go get your rope? Yeah? Did we get any votes, manager? There I go. Hide them, put them away. There, go on.
My mom said, when I was a baby, I slept for a day and a night without drinking anything. You know? Not drinking milk.
That's interesting. Can you remember it at all?
No, I cannot. But just wondering, like, maybe there's something wrong with you, but could they be, like, going to jams?
Oh, yeah, they wasn't going to jams. Sure. Because sometimes what happens is, you know, what it's like for being a baby, you've got the memory of your past life very often. Because for a baby, the past life is only a few months ago. So sometimes the babies have that memory. And so because of that, sometimes the babies, if they, you know, been in sort of a existence where they practiced jhana before, sure they'll do it. What was it, the one, forget where it was, one, I think it was in Sydney, I think. There's one Australian mother just giving birth to a baby. And, you know, just had, she was laying in the bed. The baby was on top of her. And the baby actually sat up, crossed its legs, and put its hands in a meditation pose. It freaked her out. The baby did this automatically, you know, it's laying on its back and then crossed its legs, closed its eyes. So the baby does that. It's obviously the baby had remembered something from a past life and started to meditate on its mum. It's only about a couple of hours old. So sometimes some strange things happen in the world. When you were silent like that, did you cross your legs? You didn't know. Okay, yeah. Sometimes it happens. Weird things happen. You know all those stories I say about people who speak when they're freshly born? Have you heard those stories? Yeah, great stories. It happens. Sometimes when babies are born, they speak. Not supposed to speak at all, but they do. Remember their past lives. So, yeah, it could have been the case. Who knows what it was. But give it the benefit of the doubt. And if you really want to find out, meditate. Get into such a deep meditation. What's my earliest memory? You might remember that. That's the other reason which why I teach like this, because being a scientist before and trying to get the idea of rebirth or reincarnation across the Western world, the Western world has got this huge psychological block against even the idea of reincarnation. It makes so much sense, but the problem is that people want data, want experience. So I'm trying to get as many people as possible to remember their past lives, so that they can know for sure, yes, it's not a theory, I know I did before, you can say. So that's why I encourage people to get into deep meditation. What's my earliest memory? And for you, you may remember when you were a baby. You actually know exactly what you were doing if you can go back there. It was a couple of years ago that one of the ladies from here who was on this retreat, and she started getting some nice meditation. I asked her to do that. She got some good results. But one of the results, which was the funniest, was she remembered herself as a baby. You know, very, very clear. She was maybe a 40-year-old woman. So she was back then as a baby, being held in her mother's arms. And she looked up at her mother. That's not my mother. The person holding her, cradling her, was another woman. And that again freaked her out. And when she came out afterwards, she told me in an interview, and she said, I don't know what's going on, maybe I was adopted. And I told her, well, when you get back, go and ask your mother. And that's the only way you can find out. So, when the retreat, she couldn't wait for the retreat to end. And go and ask her mother. And she went up to her mother, and just asked this question, are you my real mother? She didn't really ask it very well. So I said, what do you mean? Of course I'm your real mother. And then why do I ask that? And then she told the story, what happened in the meditation retreat. Had deep meditation, asked what's my earliest memory, got back to the time when she was a baby, being held in this person's arms. It wasn't you, mum, it was somebody else. And apparently the mother asked, what did she look like? And, you know, this 40-year-old daughter explained in detail, because these are very clear experiences, very clear memories. So you can actually see and you can actually give a very, very good description. And the mother smiled and was really impressed. She said, that was your amma, your nurse. Had come from a very wealthy family in KL. And her mother had got a nurse for her, only for the first few months. The mother was really impressed that she could give such a a great description of someone she'd only known for the first 2 or 3 months of her life, and she hadn't seen for 40 years. So that was a nice story, because it was fascinating when she had to confront her biological mother. Are you my real mother? So you can do things like that, and that gets you your own confirmation that you have lived before. You know, for a fact. So that's very good when people do that. So it's not theory anymore, it becomes fact. Oh, any other questions? Yeah, go on.
I was reading a documentary from John Deck that scientists who have been doing all this research and they're probably telescopes and things like that, and they can't go any further because they come across a black wall. So I was just thinking after this retreat now that maybe they come across, like we do, a blank whatever, that we can't penetrate beyond that until we master the meditation. But if they look, as you said, to the center of that and contemplate on that center, maybe they'll realize the universe is nothing.
I think that's just the science of actually the material world. Because you know, when you look in a telescope, you're looking back in time. And so they look back so far, they can't see the black hole. All they can actually see is what happened afterwards. But they can infer from that that the black hole where things started. But it's only the material things in this lifetime. And even modern science, and Epstein and his colleagues over in, say, Caltech or somewhere, was the latest and the most accepted theory. Because of this multi-dimensional planes, which when they intersect, that's a big bang, starts a universe, but they intersect many times. So there's a whole series of universes, universal cycles, just like the Buddha said. So the Big Bang is just only the start of this one. There's been many eons before this. So physically, we can only see so far, but mentally, you can see much more. So it's in the mind you can transcend the Big Bang. Find out what's there before, just other universes. And that's always what orders the universe. Because sometimes, even scientists sometimes say that, oh, it's just beyond a chance that we can live in such a unique universe. It can't just be the laws of physics have designed such amazing beings such as us and other people in or other animals in the universe. And it's true, because the organizing factor is actually will. If you put science and will together, there you have the force which moves the universe into order. And I said the other day, when you find out what is the creator, that creator is in there, the will, you. Not sort of some first creator, but it's all these beings with their separate wills, moving, creating, manipulating the world. And that is the organizing principle. For those of you who don't know any engineers here, but we have that, the law of entropy, which was a fundamental law of thermodynamics for many years, that entropy always decreases. Basically, that available energy always degrades. But while I was a monk, some guy got the Nobel Prize.